Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Full Tank Motorcycle Podcast. It's me, Rob, from the YouTube channel Motorbob. I'm joined by Tim, and today we're going to be talking about the BMW R1300 GS. Now, I've had it for a past couple of weeks, borrowing it as a press bike, and we posted over on the community wall on the main channel asking for your questions. So in this particular episode, we're going to run through some of the most common themes, some of the questions we picked out, and see what you guys thought of the bike as well. So, Tim, your question master today.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for giving me the privilege of testing my reading capabilities. Yeah, it's the names, isn't it? It's always the names that you stumble on. But there we go. So, well, let's start with the positive feedback. Creed M said, beautiful bike for sure. I'm not going to put the exclamation mark in there. If you yell into the mic, then I will deafen everybody listening. Ryan GN V-Town said, gold, baby. Never goes out of style. AB Abner Mendoza said, I don't need it, but I want one of these new GS. Mohammed Alhamo says, the Rolls Royce of motorbikes. That is a bold claim.
It is, but I think it's probably, I mean, name a bike that maybe the Goldwing. It's more like the Rolls Royce of motorcycles.
Yeah, I was going to say,
But actually, you put those two bikes side by side now, and the GS looks a lot more techie and feature laden and stuff like that. The Goldwing is starting to show its age a little bit, I think. The last time I borrowed one, they haven't updated it for a few years in terms of like the dash and stuff. And so it's still the most luxurious bike, in my opinion, but I can kind of see what they mean in terms of the features and stuff. Look, I think it's good to start off with some positives, mate, because these Q&As, you know, do tend out to bring out some of the less favorable opinions, let's say, about the new bikes that come out. But I think there are some big positives as well. And I think that's a fair reflection of the bike. Looks quite cool. The looks have bedded in for me. And I think specifically the reference to the gold and stuff is because I had the Tramontana Special Edition, which gets gold rims and a bit of gold on the paintwork and the green and the gold handlebars as well. I don't know if you've seen that, have you?
I've seen some posts from you, yeah. I saw it did look good.
You reckon?
The green colourway in general, but yeah, the green accented with gold is a nice nice choice. It just, yeah, it works.
Gold wheels work well. Gold on the paint. Less sure about the handlebars, but maybe you could just swap those out when you spec it up at the dealer for some black bars. But yeah, I did think it was quite a nice looking bike. A lot of people seem to like it. It seems to be one of those bikes, though, the GS, that you're either in one camp or the other. There's not many people who seem to feel indifferent about it.
Yeah. Do you think, did you get the chance to see the old one after spending time with the new one? Because often that's it for me, where I think the old one looks really good, and I'm like, oh, I'm not sure about the new looks. And then you live with the new one, go back to the old one, you go, it does look a bit dated now.
Well, I did a side-by-side comparison over at my local BMW dealership, and putting them side-by-side. Yeah, there's a big difference now. And I think you're right, like, It's hard to get on with the new styling of a particular bike or car, and people find it difficult to accept it at first. But you're so right. When you see the previous gen, after the design settled in for a few months, you do maybe think, it doesn't look quite as, you know, modern or sharp. And I think that may be the case here for some people. In fact, the next category is about the looks, so maybe we should rattle through some of those.
Indeedy. So, the Derv Man said, can you lower the screen to hide the hideous-looking radar detector?
And I think the next one is also to that effect, isn't it? From the Companion Cube.
Yeah. Said, I wished they could have kept the asymmetric headlamps from the last generation intact and integrated the radar sensor more discreetly. Apart from that, great looker.
I don't think the screen can go down over the radar. I mean, obviously, that would be bad for the radar. To have a windscreen in front of it, I assume, anyway. And it is a challenging part of the front end to kind of integrate. And that one is particularly big. But it's always going to have to be at a certain height to get the right visibility of the road. It's always going to have to be fairly flat, I guess, in terms of the front of it. So you can't really like sculpt it into the curves of the bodywork. They always seem to be black as well. I don't know if you could maybe you can't paint it or something that affects the sort of accuracy of it.
Mm-hmm. Possibly, yeah, I'd imagine so. It's one of those difficult things, isn't it? Because it is so techy. There's probably not an awful lot you can do with it, and it just kind of has to be a bolt-on lump that you can't do anything with. But I don't know. It doesn't distract me from the looks too badly. How about you? Did you think it looked ugly or...?
Not too bad. I think like maybe the KTM 1290 Super Adventure does it a little bit better. It looks smaller and it's kind of like tucked away down the bottom there. I don't even think it's that noticeable on the Multistrada V4. That one has one on the front as well. And I've not really, you know, it doesn't draw your eye quite as much. The front end of the BMW, you know what it is actually? It's like on the KTM, it's the same normal headlight, just with a little goatee of a radar sensor, if you know what I mean.
Right, okay.
Whereas with the GS, the face has been made lower where the headlight is, and then the goatee is just planted in the middle of the forehead there. That's what makes it kind of look a little bit difficult to get on with.
Kind of like RoboCop's eyes kind of thing over the top. Like, that's the eyes. Clearly it's the eyes because it's scanning the road. So, yeah.
But I will say you sort of get interesting. You get used to it, and I actually quite like the looks of it, and I sort of stopped noticing the radar there. So, yeah. Not too bad.
Next one is a man after my own heart. So, Travelling Ben said, not a fan of the beak on these. I'm going for the new Moto Guzzi Stelvio. Yes.
I would admit probably that the Stelvio is a slightly better looking bike. The thing that's interesting about the beak, mate, on the front of the R1300 GS is just how wide it is. Mm-hmm. Like, I put it side by side with the Tiger 1200. I did a comparison of those. That's got quite a slim little beak that points out the front. And when you put it next to it, you notice just how the, instead of having a slim beak and then big side panels that gives you that regular sort of aggressive, blocky adventure bike look, it's got this smooth, curving, big beak. It's like a slightly unusual look to it, definitely, versus the other adventure bikes on the market. And so it takes a little bit of a while to get used to as well. I was only wondering whether it had any practical benefits, like slightly better wind protection, or does it channel more air through the radiators or something like that? I don't know. But yeah, certainly from an aesthetic perspective, I see what he's saying about the Stelvio.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, that is what Moto Guzzi, well, in my opinion, that is what they do. It's the design, right? They are beautiful bikes.
Yeah,
generally,
wholeheartedly agree.
Nowadays, some of them were definitely fugglers in the back in the back catalogue, but yeah, definitely the modern ones are very pretty. Sticking with looks, we're going to go on to the rear lights. We've got Leo Coolix says, isn't the removal of the rear light confusing or makes you less visible? And Mr. Commuter says, why did they remove the taillight and incorporate in the blinkers? Is it really safe to ride on the road? Decent question.
Yeah, so like there's no central tail and brake light. It's effectively the two indicators are always on as the taillight, and they go obviously brighter red when you hit the brakes. But then when put an indicator on, there's an orange part that flashes, and it doesn't like kill the taillight in that particular indicator, if you know what I mean. So they're still red, but it just has an extra orange part that's flashing. To me, it looks a little bit less visible than if you just had a taillight in the middle.
I would agree, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that in cars and in bikes, and yeah, it's a surprising one for me, that, because usually with safety stuff, they tend to really restrict on that sort of stuff the other way around. Because you want to make it something like that, because for design language, it sort of sounds or looks or seems cool. But then actually when you get it on the road, you're like, it's less easy to see.
The KTM 1390 Super Duke has it as standard as well. Quite often these like features have been available as kits, like the Bonnevilles, some of those you could get a taillight delete for like the speed twin and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's available as an upgrade, or has been on the GS for a while as well, but as standard it gets them now. And yeah, so there's that concern about visibility of the indicator, which I'd imagine they've tested it and it's legal and in their tests it's a safe, because otherwise why would they do it? But just as a rider, you want full confidence that no one's going to shunt you from behind or misinterpret which way you're turning. And that just looks less clear than a tail light in the middle. And then the indicator at either side of it, relative to that tail light in the middle, kind of shows you which direction you're going. The other side of it, mate, I don't know if you ever saw that Fortnite video about Teslas and how they stopped using LiDAR, which is the same kind of like distance sensor sort of tech. I mean, that's oversimplified. It's kind of like a, it's not a radar, but you know, it gets a picture of what your distance around you. Stop using that and just went over to using cameras which do entity recognition. And I think deaths of bikers in the US from Teslas on autopilot were like suspiciously high, and the bikes that were shunted from behind were bikes that had two taillights. So some of the Harleys, for example, have the same thing, the integrated taillights. And I think the theory was that that looks like a car that's way off in the distance because they're quite close together and small.
Yes.
But actually, it's a motorcycle that's very, very close to you. And so that's why the car didn't know to stop. If it had had LiDAR, it would probably know that that's a vehicle at a certain distance, right? And so I don't know if that issue has been solved either, but it just seems like another thing that makes this feel a bit less safe. But like I say, it'd be crazy for a manufacturer like BMW to not have checked that out properly.
Yeah, which is why it's surprising it's on theirs, because this is more, I want to say, sort of custom scene, right? But doing that, it's a design.
You feel like it's a visual thing.
A practicality choice, right? It's a visual. It has to be just in the design language. Like, designer, if you're making the concept for a bike, that's the sort of thing you make in the concept, and then it gets stamped out as it gets more practical, you know, closer to production. So, yeah, surprising.
I wonder if it's also like...
But if you think they look visible, I mean, what was your opinion? You did look at them.
Well, I didn't ride behind myself at night, but when I put the indicator on, I was kind of surprised it didn't just, like, kill the taillight in that indicator. I guess it can't do that. But I was surprised it maybe didn't. I don't know. And I wonder if there's other kind of concerns that go into it, like, not concerns, but factors that feed into that design. Like, let's say you slim out the tail section of your bike significantly to give it more of that modern off-roady look, which BMW did, but you've still got to fit a luggage rack on top and then also find a place just beneath it for a new rear-facing radar for the bikes that have blind spots. Is it easy to kind of package all that stuff without a tail light and just move them to either side? Mm-hmm. But that wouldn't answer for the KTM 1390 Super Duke, for example, which is meant to be just a clean, sort of svelte-looking super naked. I would say as well, like, the tail light can be a real standout design feature of a bike. You can almost recognize immediately certain bikes. Like, I'm thinking of the SV650 with those two sticks of LEDs. Yeah. That was like a really distinctive look. Mm. And you could probably say the same for like the Moto Guzzis at the moment, like the V85 TT and the Stelvio, where they've got those jet fighter style twin.
Yeah, really nice.
Mm-hmm. And the Diavel V4. Remember with the kind of, it almost looks like a Spider-Man, like some kind of weird pattern like that. It can be a really positive thing for the looks of a bike. So if you can do that and also make it feel safer to the rider, despite whatever their testing says, I'd rather go that way personally.
I think I agree. So next one is a comparison. The the Loco Dude. See, now you set me up for failure here. I'm sticking with Loco. How does it stack up against the Triumph Tiger 1200, bearing in mind the current price difference?
So that's a video, like I say, that I was lucky enough to make last week. So I did a side-by-side with the 1250 GS and then also side-by-side with the Tiger 1200. So the Tiger 12, I went over to Fowler's, rode them back-to-back and then came back here and sort of summarized my thoughts. Like, with the Tiger 1200, when I rode it versus the 1250 GS last year, I actually kind of preferred the Tiger 1200. I think now the strong points of the Tiger 1200 still exist, like the fact that it's got that T-plane crank in the engine that gives it this kind of bit of a bark and roar to it. You know, it feels a bit more exciting than the sort of flat-ish sound of a boxer twin. It just feels a bit more sporty as well because of the suspension and brakes. They're a little bit more, like, just slightly sharper on the brakes, more feedback from the front from the traditional fork. The GS is still doing its GS thing, but just even better. So, you know, the engine hasn't markedly changed in terms of character. The handling hasn't markedly changed in terms of character, apart from it's, like, lighter and feels more compact. Mm-hmm. And it's just added loads and loads of tech and kind of you know, the radars and the adaptive ride height, and a lot of it's quite comfort focused. It feels like a more usable, comfortable bike that's going to look after you if you're doing like long distances. So watch the video anyway, because it'll give you more detail on that. But the fundamental outcome of doing that head to head is that the Tiger is still, I think, more lively and engaging. The GS is even better at the comfort thing. So it's similar conclusions to last time, just that the GS is even stronger at what it already does. The only downside is the price has gone up a bit. And so maybe that's going to factor in. I think that's part of this question as well, isn't it? Bearing in mind the current price difference.
Yes, bearing in mind.
But I still think like the price difference, if you spec them up similarly, you're talking about $1,000 or $2,000. And if you're a GS fan and you're really looking for like the most comfortable or techie bike, I'd rather save up for that or try and find that somewhere, especially at this price level. You know, a £2,000 difference down at budget bike level, let's say you buy an entry level Naked and you're talking $5,000 or $7,000, that's a big chunk of the price. But if you're someone who can afford a £20,000 bike, I'd try and find that money somewhere to get the one you really wanted. So I still don't think the price difference is enough to be like the deciding factor when you're starting to pay this amount of money.
Yeah, valid point. It does change as the price goes. You are quite right, because then it becomes, I guess, a smaller percentage of the whole as well, right?
Yes.
In terms of the difference. The other comparison is in-house. So it's versus the 1250 GS. Hoppy Buddha, definitely said that one, right?
Well done, mate.
Said, I am considering to buy GS 1250 this month. 1250A, sorry, this month.
Mm.
Quite unsure if it's worth to wait for the 1300 GS to arrive in the next couple of months. What's your thought? And Biker in Beta, is it a worthy upgrade if you already are settled in on the previous gen with your own custom stuff? That's a decent question. But then if you've got your own custom parts on your GS, I don't know whether I would upgrade.
Okay, let's tackle the first one. You know the GS Adventure with the big 30-litre tank? There's absolutely no way that that's not coming at some point. There's no way they'd build this whole new platform and then not build a GS Adventure version of it. And, you know, if you look at the sales for the GS and the GS Adventure for the 1250 version, they were pretty much even. They were very similar in terms of popularity. So that's absolutely coming. I think if I was looking at a 1250 GSA, the only thing is, like, you're not sure when it'll arrive. And then bikes, because of, like, supply chain stuff over the last couple of years being less smooth, seem to take longer to get in dealers as well. And so you might miss this summer waiting for that GS Adventure. I've got no idea. You may not, but also you might. And so maybe if you've got a big trip planned or whatever, you may as well just go in on the GS Adventure. If you're not that bothered and your current bike is pretty good, I think probably, given how much I felt there was a big step up in terms of comfort on the regular model, and given that GS Adventure with that big 30-litre tank is more distance-focused, that is going to be an absolute monster of a distance bike. It's going to have more range than any other motorcycle pretty much in the large capacity segment. And then if it adds all the radars and stuff and the extra bits of comfort and tech, like I say, I think it's just going to be phenomenal. So I think I'd wait if I could. Depends what your current bike situation is like. As for whether it's worth upgrading versus the previous gen if you settled in with your own custom stuff, again, so many factors go into that, like your personal financial situation and also what that custom stuff is. Like if you've stuck, you know, some extra lights on it and a couple of extra bits like that, maybe it's not such a big deal. But if you've gone really deep with lots of accessories, it's quite hard to get your money back when you trade the bike in or sell it privately, because not everybody wants to pay for that stuff. The fundamentals of that bike are not that different. The engine doesn't feel that different. The front end with the handling, with the telelever, it's enhanced. And like I said, the bike's lighter, but it still handles in that telelever way. And when you ride it versus the competition, you still feel that it's more comfort biased than it is like really sporty and has great feel from the front and stuff. So if it's the basics of the bike that you like, probably it's not going to feel like a huge step up. If it is all the techie bits that you like, then maybe go and have a look and have a test ride and figure out if you're going to use that stuff. And that's probably where it'll be worth it.
Yeah, yeah. Next one is versus the F900 GS. Bernard Visaggi. Mate, do you know when F900 GS reviews are dropping? It's like BMW purposefully kept it back to keep the 1300 GS hype train going. I think you might have some sort of point there. Toe Jam Timmy.
Is that you?
Love it. That's a great name. Favorite? No. he says, my only question is, what's the new F900GS like?
It's taken a big step up in power, the F900GS. Well, not big, but yeah, like a bit of a step up, because they obviously got rid of the old, was it 850 engine, and they put the 900 engine in from the F900R and F900XR. So yeah, sorry, a bit of a step up in power. But more than that, they've made this like much leaner looking, slightly lighter, I think, and also much more off-road biased kind of bike that's more similar now to something like a Tenere, although a bit bigger, or an 890 Adventure. Yeah. Like, in a way, I think that's actually widened the gap between what those two bikes do. Naturally, you can ride the R1300GS off-road if you want to. There's the GS Trophy competition that proves you can do that quite extensively. But really, I think that's the one I'd be looking at for touring and adventure touring and that sort of thing. The F900GS has become less of a touring-focused bike and more of an off-roader. And so I think they've become slightly further apart in their intended purpose. As for whether they're holding it back, I believe it, like the launch is happening in the next, I don't know, few weeks. And then we might be able to start getting press bikes in sort of late Feb or March or something like that. I don't know if that's intentional, but I think, of course, if you're a business trying to sell as many bikes as possible, you're going to space out your launches and announcements so they get a decent amount of coverage. You know, like...
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little bit of a hangover from print, I suppose, where there's a monthly magazine and there's only one bike that can go on the front cover. And so if you want to be on the front cover of all the bike mags, you better choose... certainly you're going to try and choose a month where your competitors haven't got anything as interesting as you, but you're almost definitely not going to announce it at the same time as the 1300GS or let people ride it to get a review at the same time as the 1300GS, because that's such an important big selling bike that's going to be on the front cover of all the mags, and no one's going to cover the...
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to sort of go, oh, look, we've got five new bikes for this year. Here's all of them at once. Do with it as you will. It just makes no sense. Yeah, so it will be staggered, yeah.
But like, yeah, I'm obviously going to try and get hold of one of those as quick as I can. I think they look quite cool now. But I'm not expecting I'm not expecting its step up in capability to have cannibalized the market for the R1300GS. I think they're different.
So the next point is on price. Always a fun topic. Right, so Moto Adventure Dual Sport says, a new level of yuppie biking. Nice. Art Chambaud says, good machine. When it's 6 years old, I can afford it. If I want one, probably not though. Stafford Video Productions says, I can afford 8K, not 23K. And Isaisen says, impossibly beautiful, €35,000 in my country. Jeez.
Yes. I mean, the price is always going to be a bit of a sticking point. I think like the base model is about $15,995 now. But in terms of like the bikes they're giving out to the press that are fully spec'd up, there's like a $7,000 difference. So I've tried to mention that in every video quite clearly, that the bike that I've spec'd is, bike that I borrowed is spec'd to like nearly $23,000. I don't know. It's hard to say whether that's worth it. All the bikes in that segment, you know, the Multistrada V4 starts at $16,995, I think, for the most basic version. The KTM 1290 Super Adventure S starts at $17,500, I think, now this year. It's gone up by £1,000 versus last year. The Tiger is more like $15,000, but even like the Pan America, it starts at the same sort of 16-ish as the GS, and then the Pan America Special is 17 or so. So I think it's not just BMW. This whole market is around that sort of price point now. And as to whether that's appropriate for the bikes, that's very hard to say, mate, isn't it? I mean, what do you think? Is that just they're still selling huge volumes, the GS. So like, surely it's not necessarily damaging it in any way, but... It is crazy money, isn't it, really?
It's at its market. I mean, I've absolutely given up on justifying prices, on questioning prices. Prices are what they are. And it's, you know, if it didn't work, they wouldn't sell. There you go. That's as clean as it can be, right? Yeah. So obviously they've tested the market, and obviously they're still selling them. So I'm gutted because, yeah, I'd love to have one for £1,000, but which is about all I can afford right now. But yeah, I think it compared to the rest of their market, I guess they're in the same sort of frame. And it is like flagship bike. When you're talking about the tech that's on these things as well, right? Yeah. They've thrown everything at this level of bike, right? If you want something a bit cheaper, then unfortunately you have to go for something a bit simpler. But there you go.
Personally, I would say my recommendation, if you want an adventure bike on a budget, I don't know. I can't really speak for like the long-term reliability.
An old Africa Twin.
Yeah, an old Africa Twin. Want. Although you are somewhat biased. I've got an old Tiger 800, so I'd be somewhat biased towards
there
that.
You go.
No, obviously used bikes, you know, you're going to get a lot more bang for your buck. But if you got your heart set on new for whatever reason, you prefer the confidence that a warranty gives you and all that stuff. I really think the fact that the Tenere used to be $8,000, but is now up around the $10,000 mark, and it's still quite a basic bike, has made it, I mean, if you're off-roading, it's still a great choice, but it's made it less easy to just be the default recommendation for like an affordable adventure bike. Where I'm looking now is at the KTM 790 Adventure. It's a slightly smaller version of the 890, yeah. Made out in China by CF mm-hmm. Moto, but we've both been impressed by the build quality mm-hmm. on the CF Motos. Like I say, I can't speak for long-term reliability, but effectively what you're getting is very near the capability of the 890 Adventure. It's also inherited some of the styling as well now, so it doesn't look quite as, mm-hmm. Uneasy on the eye. I think that... That for me, 790 Adventure, it's $10,500 now, will do a lot for the money.
I think I agree with you. Yeah, going around Motorcycle Live, that is, you're right. That's the one I could remember being like, oh yeah, no, decent price.
But yeah, sorry, I think I agree on the big picture. It's just, it depends on your financial means and also depends on their pricing strategy, which I'm sure is like a whole department where they try and find a sweet spot. Between how much can we charge and how many bikes can we sell? But it does suck for your average biker, I think. Oh, and also, sorry, last thing on this, mate. I think over the last few years, prices were creeping up because people started financing their bikes and then just PCP them, pay a couple hundred quid a month for like a fancy bike like this. And then it gets to the end of its term and you just chop it in and get a new one. And that's quite exciting. And then you just pay a couple hundred quid a month for that. And in a way, you know, that's not a terrible idea, especially if it helps cut down on your cost of commuting or whatever. But the interest rates now are phenomenal. And what used to be a 200 quid a month bike is now 3 or 4, maybe, I don't know, like 300 quid or something like that. It's like such a big step up. It's not, you know, interest going up by a few percent. I think when it translates to the monthlies, it's actually quite a big difference. And so I think that's also, people are feeling the sort of prices of them now, even on those monthly levels. So I think it's tricky times at the moment for some people trying to sell bikes, but...
Just across the board, it's hard getting a weekly shopping.
Exactly.
Let alone getting a bike. So the next one is on Ergos. We've got Mr. Royne says, seat height availability, preferably seat height comparison with different heighted people. NSH says, I took a demo ride on the 1300 GS and weirdly I felt the seat comfort. To be specific, the angle at which the rider sits was much better on the 1250. Not sure if it was just me or you noticed that too.
Good question.
Did you notice it too?
I think it's this thing that I've mentioned before on the pod, which is that I'm not sure if it's just the angle, but generally I kind of prefer slightly firmer seats. I think they just put the pressure on your sit bones in your butt rather than just spreading the pressure all over your butt cheeks. And the softer saddle that I found on the 1250 GS and slightly softer saddle on stuff like the Pan America, for me, just gives you that all over pressure, which is slightly less comfortable. It just felt a bit firmer. I think I had the comfort heated seat on the 1300 GS press bike I borrowed. Slightly firmer and just puts the pressure in the right places so it's more comfortable over time. So that's kind of what I found comfort-wise. And generally, I would say, unless it's rock hard, I sort of slightly prefer that firmer foam in the seat. And then onto the seat height differences. Well, it's 850mm as standard. With the adaptive ride height, it's 820. So it slows, as you slow down to a stop, it'll drop both the front and rear shocks so the bike sits down. You never notice it happening. It's so weird. When you're moving, you feel like you're on a big, tall adventure bike. when you stop, you feel like you're on just like a normal street bike. And I think it's really, really well implemented. Yeah. So if you are a bit challenged in terms of like height, for someone like me who's 5'9 or 175 centimeters, so I'm not massively tall, it just felt super easy to get on with. And I'd be really confident on that bike, even if I had luggage, passenger, and it was all, you know, top heavy. I think it'd do a solid job there with that kind of setup. There are some different seat heights. I think you can get a higher one and a lower one. So I think maybe like 20 mil either way. So obviously with the adaptive ride height and the low seat, you can get it a little bit lower as well. But there is also a sports suspension package, which is like sport in the off-road sense, which gives it more travel. And I think that lifts it again. So if you had the high seat and the sports suspension package, you can go up to something like 890 perhaps. So there's like a massive range basically with all these different features. Yeah, and I think just go to the dealer and discuss kind of which one you want. But, you know, as for what's going to fit what height of rider, I'd say for my height, 850, and then the adaptive, well, 850 would be fine for me, but then with the adaptive ride height as well, it makes it feel like a doddle. Anyone shorter, look for the low seat and the adaptive ride height, especially if you're going to load it up for touring. Anyone taller, there's the tall seat, and maybe the adaptive ride height becomes less appealing. Or you could go standard seat and no adaptive ride height. But I guess what the difference, different height in seat is going to give you that the ride height doesn't is the gap between the pegs and the seat. So if you feel cramped on the standard seat, put the tall one on and that'll open up that leg angle. But then maybe you still find it a reach down to the floor when you stop. Adaptive ride height is a good thing. So although there's all those different combos, they do slightly different things, if you know what I'm saying. One could be comfort on the bike. Whereas like the seat height and the ride height are going to affect how it feels to get your feet down.
Makes sense. It sounds to me like that is the biggest range in seat heights of any bike I've heard of recently. But it is quite a particular thing. When I was trying to sell the Africa Twin, I did notice that was a huge part of people just turning up just to have a sit on it to see whether or not their legs dangled.
Mate.
And it was frustrating because I'm not a dealership and I couldn't sort out for them. There we go.
I think that's partly why people love going to motorcycle shows and sitting on them. They just get a sense of whether the bike's going to fit them or not. And absolutely, that is question number one, I suppose, for a lot of people. If you don't feel comfy on it, then, you know, is that going to be fun to ride? Possibly not. You know, this is common as well in the large adventure market. Like if you look at the Multistrada V4, it can go from 840 to 860 adjustable seat height, which the GS doesn't have an adjustable standard seat, but that does. And then there's a high accessory which can go from 855 to 875, and a low accessory that goes from 810 to 830, I think. And there might even be more adjustment with suspension packages. I'm not quite sure. But effectively, you're going from 810 as the lowest right up to 875. And I think it's just possibly the kind of sheer... Oh, no, you can get the low seat and low suspension kit and go as low as 790. So, like... I think it's just the size of the bikes that for some people want a big bike like that because they are tall. And so they want that tall seat so that they feel comfortable and not cramped on it. But also because they're such big bikes, but still appealing to shorter riders, you really have to give it that full range of making it comfortable for everybody and make it feel like they can get their feet down, because they're all around 240 kilos before you even start adding luggage and accessories and stuff. So I think that explains the sort of variation, whereas like a little naked bike or whatever, you know, most people are just happy to jump on and get on with it.
Very true. So the next point is the quick shifter. So you've got Shisawi says, how is the witch shifter? Is it smoother? Do you notice a significant difference between the riding modes? And Sober Daytona says, quick shifter, how bad is it? Loaded question. Terribly, shamefully bad, like the 1250. I think they've got some opinions there.
Yeah. The witch shifter, I assume, is an autocorrect or typo, but there isn't any sort of supernatural features on the new 1300 GS.
I like witch shifter. I prefer that.
There's a witch in the road and it just shifts them. I wouldn't say it's massively better than the previous gen. It's still quite clunky. It works quite nicely on the downshift. Like it sort of feels smooth and like not that much effort. On the upshift though, it's like a requires quite a lot of force with the foot, and then there's quite a clunk. And it's better as you get up in the high revs, but certainly in that mid-range, when you're just generally pottering about and that, it isn't as slick as something like the Tiger 1200, which I was, like I say, rode it back-to-back with, and it was much more capable at all different rev ranges and just smoother and requires less force and just felt... Like I say, there's all these little things that just made it more fun to ride, like, quicker.
Yeah.
And I kind of was at the point where I was just using the clutch a lot on the GS, especially in the low revs.
Sure.
Or low to mid revs. If you're nailing it, you might use the quick shifter. I would also say the bike only had a few hundred miles on it, so it might free up after a while.
True.
And I was definitely banging down the box with the blipper when I was going into corners and stuff, and that felt quite good. But yeah, it was just those upshifts didn't feel like that great to me. So I don't think it's a massive improvement. And that has me wondering whether it's a fundamental thing about the... I mean, they reworked, they moved the gearbox and stuff and changed quite a lot on this bike. The engine's kind of redesigned, you know, quite a lot. Well, from the ground up, really. But I just wonder if there's something about that engine configuration or something technical about it that just makes it difficult to make a smooth quick shifter.
Yeah, maybe, because it is such a solid lump of a thing. It does feel very mechanical. Not mechanical, but just there's a real weight to it, isn't
there? Yep.
So maybe that's what it is. It's just harder to move. Moving on, we have the most important question with any bike, obviously, sound. So we've got Sunil Mundry, who says, what do you think of the exhaust sound?
Are you a fan of a Boxer in terms of sound?
Nope. No, I'm not.
It's another...
Not usually, no. I mean, like, there are some times where I'm like, ah, it's okay. And if we live with it for longer, with the R9T that I had for longer, eventually it sort of grew on me, but generally, no.
It's like, I think it's a familiarity thing. When you start to enjoy BMWs and you get into the lifestyle and the brand, and there are some benefits. They're really talky. They're really smooth, like I say. There's a lot of good stuff about them. Then maybe it's that... That sound actually reminds you of what it feels like to ride the Boxer, and so that's why you get pleasure from it. But I think, just like, if you took it in isolation, remove the riding experience, and compared that sound to a Revy inline four, or like, well, not in this market, but like, let's say the Big V-Twin in the Supra Adventure, or the T-Plane Crank in the Triumph, or the Multistrada V4, it's just not as exciting a sound. It just isn't. It's like, wah. That's the best impression.
Go on, give me your best impression of it. No, go.
That was it. Wah. And when it's accelerating, it's like, wah. That's it. And it's not got that, like, growl, which I can't do. I can't do all the different ones. But you know what I mean? Exactly.
It's like a really nice,
that was really
yeah,
good,
like a really
mate.
Nice twin.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Exactly. Those two clips are actually perfect. It is like a just a. Yeah, it doesn't light the. Ignite the soul, does it? The Boxer sound. If you like the Boxer twin, it actually is like quite a nice sounding version of it. It's got a very small silencer because they moved all the cat underneath, I guess, and all that sort of stuff, or maybe part of the silencing, you know, system. So it's got this little small end can, and it does sound quite decent. And when you give it loads of revs on the downshifts and stuff, or if you're just revving it static, you do get those little pops and stuff that makes it sound quite sporty. And there is an exhaust control valve as well, I noticed, on the link pipe from the cat up to the silencer. And so I'm guessing that maybe that opens up when you're accelerating quite hard and gives it more of the, you know, the big bark of that kind of engine. Not bark, but like... I don't know. It gives you more of the box.
It's a spark with a lot of A's in it. Yeah, it's bark. Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, if you like it, you'll probably, you know, if you like that sound, then it'll probably be a good thing.
Yeah.
If you don't like Boxers, then nah, it's not the one. It's not the one I'd pick. You know what? There was, I saw last year as a Christmas gift that was available, a company was making a two-stroke doorbell. So it was just the doorbell thing, and then, like, you know, you stick the little
awesome.
Door. And it was like a wireless doorbell, and you put the speaker somewhere cool. in your house, and you press it and just did a two-stroke sound. Brilliant idea.
Awesome.
I don't you know, if I was choosing my doorbell and I was limited to these large adventure bikes, I'd probably choose like the Multistrada, but I can't, it, you know, the Boxer Twin, every time someone rang the door, I think it'd be low on the list. Sorry to say.
you'd be angry. At least you get to the door quick because you'd want it to stop. Right, sorry to anyone we've offended with that one. Genuinely went a little hard, I'm going to say, with the exhaust note thing. It's not that bad. So the last question is on wheels, or last point. So Satyameva Jayet Jaihind said, are these cross-spoke wheels tubeless tyres?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. That's the long and short of it, mate.
There you go.
Tubeless. This is coming up quite a lot, though, lately on some of my reviews, just like which bikes are tubeless and which aren't. Like... I had that.
Aren't most of them now? It's the majority, right?
Well, you would think so, but I had the Fantic Caballero 700 the other week just before Christmas. That was tube type. My Tiger is tube type as well, and it's a constant source of anxiety when I'm going and picking press bikes up. I'm like, I just can't afford to lose time today. So I actually carry a little tail pack that I got from Lone Rider with some... Do you know slime, where you just you remove the valve core with a little tool?
I do.
Put the slime in. They have a product that's two in one, and it does both inner tubes and the tire. So you can use it for any bike.
Okay.
Not bad. So yeah, I carry some of that around me with me with a pair of pliers to pull anything out. And or you probably want to leave it in if you've got a nail in there and you just want to get somewhere. And I actually take like an electric pump with that you can plug into a 12-volt socket, but then I've got a 12-volt to crocodile clip converter, so I can clip it to the battery terminals of any bike, just get it pumped up quickly, get back on the road. Time is money, Tim, okay? So you got to be prepared. But like, I'd just rather not have that stress and just take a plug. Although, I don't know, hopefully the slime's as good as the plug, but I just feel like I'm carrying a lot of stuff there. And then also...
Yeah, you could simplify it, yeah.
I think it's the V-Strom 1050 I tested out last year. I didn't do that much riding with it. I just did like a day on it just to do the first impressions kind of thing. But I'm pretty sure that has tubeless on the rear and tube type on the front.
The hell is that? Surely not.
You've got to take a bit of everything. Good times.
That's that. The what? The worst of both worlds. Great.
Well, yeah, just carry the most stuff. I mean, at least... It's easier to get the front wheel off, right? So if you have to change a tube, you probably want it to be that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a weak argument, but yeah, fine. I think that's a budgetary. There's no, that's budget, surely.
Mate, the V-Strom 1050 is entirely, I think, a bike built to a budget and therefore constrained in certain ways. Like, it's not bad given the price, but yeah, it's sure. Not a money no object kind of bike like the Multistrada V4 RS or whatever that's like 30 odd grand. But yeah, it is a big deal, so I appreciate that last question. Even though it seems like a minor detail, actually when you get a puncture it can be really annoying, as I've found out on the V-Strom 800.
Remember, yes,
I mentioned that recently, when it's flat and it's tube type, I didn't have the slime with me. I had to get a lift and then go back with the van to pick it up. Good times, mate.
I've been there several times. Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about.
How's the new bike hunt going? I thought you were trying to... you've not sold the Africa Twin then yet.
Yeah, I have, yeah. It's gone.
Oh, you finally got someone to buy it?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just slipped that in there.
So you're bikeless?
Yeah. I found someone to buy it. Do you know who I found to buy it, mate? The person I bought it from, as in the previous owner who sold it to a garage that I bought it from, and he found it on eBay and went, is that my bike? And I went, oh, I don't know. Here's the reg. And he went, yeah, that is my motorcycle. So he bought it back because he missed it that much, which proves how good it was.
Do you think he just couldn't... So that has gone. You know, there's a stand-up who used to do a joke where it was like, if you can't be bothered to do your laundry, just give it to a charity shop and buy it back for 20p.
Sure.
Is that what happened? Yeah. He couldn't be asked to service it. Yeah.
Well, if that was his game, then joke's on him. Because, no, I actually did service it twice, in fact, because the freaking garage decided to do it half once and half a second. So, yeah, bring it back into us and we'll do half now and half later. So, anyway, that's gone. And I have a new bike. And I think it may surprise you what
I have. Oh, jeez, man.
It's not a motor Guzzi. I'll start you off with that at least, right? Do you even want to guess or do you just want me to tell you? It'd be a long guess.
Well, I mean, if you can give me some, like...
some pointers?
Just some clues, like, okay, to narrow it down. Well, let me. Is it? Let's do 10 questions, not 20. 20's too many.
Yes.
Okay. Number one, is it Japanese?
Okay. No.
Is it a twin?
Yes.
Is it a retro?
It's old.
Oh, Jesus. Not a retro.
I'll get, instead of retro, I'm just going to say that it's of its time, but it is a 2004.
Is it Italian?
Yeah.
Is it an Aprilia?
No.
Is it a Ducati?
Yes.
Is it a Monster?
Yes.
That's seven questions. Do I win or not?
I mean, you're pretty much there. Yeah, I think you
win. Is it 1200?
I mean, if you really want to get to the nitty gritty. No, it's do you want me to tell you?
Yeah.
It is an S2R 800. It's the bike that we've actually already got one in the family, so I know I like it. We've got a red one, and now I have a black one.
So you now need to get your brother one, and then you can all ride around on him together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So,
sorry, what colour's yours?
Yeah, I went for that. So mine is black. It's it was much less common. My dad reckoned it'd been resprayed, but they did do it in black. So it's it's just a black
is he,
out
is he,
I don't know if it had a specific name.
Is he slagging yours off because he's like
100%. Yeah.
Because he's got one and you've shown up with one, he's like, nah, it's resprayed, mate. It's rubbish.
Yeah, exactly. He's definitely of the opinion his is better. And I don't know yet. I haven't seen mine, so I can't.
Oh, you've bought it, but you haven't got it.
Yeah, so it was in Coventry. My brother lives in Coventry, so he picked it up for me. He sat there.
What a kind offer. I'll get it for you, mate. No worries.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'll just take it straight home. Yeah, I'll just stick it in the garage.
He didn't even show me the mileage. It's a good point. it's sat there for the moment. And obviously, whilst the weather is bad, but more specifically, whilst there is a buttload of salt on the roads, I'm going to leave it there for a bit and then take it back when I have the space for it here, because we've moved house as well.
Oh, so
lots going on all at once. But so I'm looking forward to riding it. It's a great
bike.
You
need to clear a little area in the living room. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we're on the second floor as well, so it's going to be tough, but not impossible.
Oh, beautiful. I can't wait to see it. When did it last have its belts done?
Recently. Yeah, recently.
All right. Well, that sounds like...
According to the description of the person.
That sounds like some hassle-free motoring ahead of you then.
Yeah, right. It's Italian. What can go wrong? It's Italian and it's 20 years old. No issue.
So, a massive thanks to everybody who submitted questions to this one. And we'll run a few more of these. We've got some interesting bikes coming up. ZX4RR in the garage at the moment. I'm looking at it right now. Followed up by the ZX6R. Yeah. So I'm going to back-to-back those and see whether the 400 or 600 makes more sense for the road. What else have I got, mate? Oh, Desert X. I'm revisiting it because everyone raves about it. But I only did like one day on it. And I actually was like half a day on a lead ride. The new Royal Enfield shotgun, which I assume you'll get a chance to have a ride on soon. Hopefully.
I definitely will. Yeah, yeah. I wonder whether that's as close to the Meteor as obviously it should be.
We'll compare notes on that one, mate. And what else have I got lined up? Ooh, I think that's the most immediate ones. Trying to get hold of the New Africa Twin. Trying to get hold of the Triumph 400. So they're on the list as well. But we'll do some more Q&As and try and deal with those most common questions. It's really helpful when people submit them. So thank you very much. For anyone we missed... In terms of the questions asked, it's because there's a little bit of duplication. So we try and just pick out, you know, a handful of questions that represent each theme. But please don't lose faith. You may make it into the next one. And we appreciate them all the same. Many thanks, Tim, for being the question master. You absolutely butchered most of these usernames. But the reading of the questions was excellent.
If you want to hear your name butchered by Tim next time, then please submit your questions. Yeah. Or he's going to read your name out phonetically.
I'm going to spell them out.
I make no apologies for it.
I'm going to have to spell them out. And like, you know, is that phonetic spelling where they put like...
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I'll
do
that for you, mate. And next time, and then it'll go...
Thank you.
You'll sound like so cultured and worldly when you read out these, you know... unusual usernames from around the world perfectly. So look forward to that, everyone, in the next episode. Many thanks for listening today. See you next time.
Bye.